Welcome to our CE presentation entitled Nursing Insights on the Management of Patients with ALL/LBL Treated with Asparaginase Therapy. Today's program is provided by Medicom Worldwide and is supported by an independent medical education grant from Jazz Pharmaceuticals. It's now my pleasure to turn the webcast over to Sandra Curtin, PhD, ANPC, AOCN, FAPO, Assistant Professor of Clinical Medicine, Adjunct Clinical Professor of Nursing, the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Director at Advanced Practice Hematology Oncology Nurse Practitioner, the University of Arizona Cancer Center in Tucson, Arizona. Dr. Curtin, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much and welcome everyone. Good evening. I am Sandy Curtin and I'm very pleased to be here tonight to talk to you about ALL and LBL. We'll get more into that. And then very specifically spend time talking about asparaginase therapies in these patients. So next slide, please. These are objectives, so we're going to really talk about what the current guidelines are for asparaginase therapies in these populations, including adolescents, young adults, and adults, and we'll get more into all of that. Really looking at hypersensitivity specifically with asparaginase, and then what the role of a serum asparaginase activity level is in determining the benefits and or barriers to effective therapy. And then really, how do we educate our patients and families about this therapy? Next slide, please. These are my disclosures. So we'll get into the content now. So we're going to talk tonight about acute lymphoblastic leukemia, or ALL, and lymphoblastic lymphoma, or LBL. And these are morphologically very much the same. They can be either B cell or T cell in origin. And as you can see here, in adults, 90% of these patients have a LL, and that is characterized by greater than 25% bone marrow blasts. And in lymphoblastic lymphoma, they tend to have more nodal disease and fewer blasts in the bone marrow, so less than 25% bone marrow blasts. And then in each category, you can see they're either categorized to B cell or T cell. In adults, B cell ALL is more common than T cell. T cell is more common in younger patients. And LBL, or lymphoblastic lymphoma, is more commonly T cell and less commonly B cell. Most of the B cell patients, or 75% of those, have mature B cell disease. This is less favorable and it requires intensive therapy moving into an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And then in the pre-B cell ALL, this is more common in children and adolescents and young adults, or AYA. T cell ALL is more favorable in adults at initial diagnosis. However, if they have incomplete treatment, they don't do well and then need to definitely go to an allogeneic stem cell transplant. And these patients more commonly, as I mentioned, have nodal disease, so large mediastinal masses or other nodal regions. Lymphoblastic lymphoma similarly has more nodal disease, and again, less than 20 to 25% blasts. This is more common in children and particularly young males. And collectively, these patients are all treated with ALL-like regimens. So we'll go to the next slide, please. And this is just a different way of looking at that. I think the last layer here is that we look at whether or not they carry the Philadelphia chromosome. And so in patients with B cell ALL, we test for BCR-ABL, which is the molecular abnormality or mutation that we see in CML, chronic myelogenous leukemia, but can also be present in these B-cell ALL patients. And for those patients, then we talk about adding a tyrosine kinase inhibitor like we would use for CML. Next slide, please. And then this is just another way of looking at risk, stratifying that based on Philadelphia chromosome positive or negative. We'll add a TKI, tyrosine kinase inhibitor. These are drugs like dasatinib is the most common one, or Sprycel, and less commonly nilotinib or some of the other TKIs. If they're pH negative, regardless of group, it's going to really depend on fitness and or frailty and what can they tolerate. And but the largest group is going to get pediatric inspired ALL regimens. So we're going to talk more about that. Next slide, please. So those regimens are very intensive. Probably the most complicated things that we do in patients, in my experience, I've been doing this a really long time, 38 years. And these are patients who, for females, get 2 years of therapy, and the first 6 months are very intensive. And for males, because they have sanctuary sites in the testes, are treated for 3 years. And those are patients who don't require transplant. And patients who require a transplant, they may get some or all of that and then go to transplant. And the therapy is basically in several phases. So we have induction. You can see there are multiple drugs that are used here. And then you see that for those that are Philadelphia chromosome positive, we're going to add that TKI. If they're negative, there's no role for that. All patients need central nervous system prophylaxis, because that's another sanctuary site. And standard therapy does not penetrate the blood-brain barrier. But you can see that asparaginase is very much a part of this initial therapy, induction, consolidation, and maintenance to some degree. It goes away toward the maintenance phase. And then for those who have relapse or refractory disease, we'll move to some of the newer targeted therapies like blinatumomab and inotuzumab. And then for those who are either multiple relapse or refractory or on a clinical trial, we'll start looking at things like CAR T therapy or an allotransplant. But it is very intensive, and asparaginase plays a very important role in the initial therapy for these patients. Next slide, please. So let's talk more about that. So we're going to focus on asparaginase therapy in adolescents, young adults, and adults. Next slide. So this is the trajectory over time. So in the early or in the 70s, we had E. coli derived or native L-asparaginase. And this was approved as a part of this multi-agent regimen that I just described. And it wasn't until 1994 that we had a pegylated version of that, also E. coli derived. And this was for primarily patients who had reactions to that native formulation, E. coli derived L-asparaginase. And again, part of that multi-agent regimen. In 2000, we began to have data on therapeutic drug monitoring. We're going to talk more about that, or TDM. And it wasn't until 2006 where we had pegasparaginase as a newly approved frontline agent to be used in these regimens. So moving ahead of the E. coli derived native. So in other words, you didn't have to wait to react to that. You could just start with pegasparaginase. So it's largely took over that frontline setting, given the number of patients that reacted to that native E. coli derived formulation. And then more recently, we have novel compounds. So there are FDA approved for second line in case of hypersensitivity. We have calasparaginase, also a pegylated compound. This is Erwinia derived, so it's different than E. coli. They're completely different bacterial entities. And then in 2021, Erwinia chrysanthemi asparaginase, which is a recombinant formulation, also not E. coli derived. So these are very different compounds. We have had drug shortages. And so for that reason, there has been some stratification in prioritization to make sure everybody has access to these very important drugs. Next slide, please. So let's talk, I'll come back to that, but let's talk first about how asparaginase works. So asparaginase is an enzyme. It hydrolyzes asparagine into aspartic acid and ammonia. You can see that in the cartoon on the right. So as you give, have asparagine hydrolysis or breakdown, you decrease asparagine, and that causes leukemic cell death. Leukemia cells require asparagine to grow and progress. So less asparagine is good. That's reducing the risk of leukemic transformation or progression but when that breaks down, you can have also the development of aspartic acid and ammonia. So this is really important when we're looking at adverse events, because as you break down asparagine, you can produce ammonia as a part of that process. So we'll come back to that. But really important to understand, less asparagine is good. That means less leukemic cell death. And the other important thing about asparaginase exposure over time is that the 5-year event-free survival is inferior in patients who have incomplete therapy. So less than 25 weeks of therapy compared to at least 26 weeks, the 5-year survival is 73% in those that do not complete therapy versus 90%. So really important to make sure people are receiving the amount of asparaginase that they should, according to protocols, to improve their response and survival over time. Also, we need to measure ammonia levels. So this is something that is not intuitive. You have to add it. It's not part of a metabolic panel, but it's something that's really important in differentiating whether patients are having hypersensitivity reactions or perhaps this process of silent inactivation, in which we consider this ammonia level as a part of that process. Next slide, please. These are the different formulations, and again, their type or species. So they're derived from either E. coli or Erwinia. And it's really important to understand those are very different compounds. They are not cross-reactive in that sense. And then because of the shortage of drugs globally, there's been a prioritization to use the calasparaginase for pediatric only. So 1 month up to age 21. And only the pegylated formulation is available in pediatrics. And then you can use a pegasparaginase in age greater than 22. And then also the Erwinia chrysanthemi as a second line if they've had hypersensitivity to one of the E. coli derived, like pegasparaginase, for those patients. Next slide, please. And then this is really important as well. So in addition to that age stratification, it's really important to understand that these are not interchangeable. So they have different half-lives and routes of administration. And that has everything to do with how frequently you give them based on that half-life. So you can see, for instance, the calasparaginase, which is again, primarily pediatric, given IV, the half-life is extended, and so you would give it no more frequently than every 21 days. Whereas pegasparaginase is given IM or IV, and it can have a variety of half-lives, but anywhere from 4.9 to 5.7 days. And then you go down to Erwinia chrysanthemi, and it's given IM, and it has a very short half-life, 15.9 hours, so less than 24 hours. And so you can see that it's dosed much more frequently. So really important to understand the formulation, the half-life, the route of administration, and how frequently you would be administering that drug. Next slide, please. And this is just echoing the stratification of age and really making sure that every patient with ALL or LBL has access to asparaginase in their treatment because it is so critical to their overall outcomes. Next slide, please. These are really the ones that we're working with because the others have been unavailable due to shortages. So I won't go back through this again. We'll go to the next slide, please. So here's our first case. This is our 24-year-old female. She has T-cell ALL. She's presenting to the ER with cervical adenopathy, bruising, headaches, bone pain, and chest pressure. Has a biopsy and it's TDT positive, which is indicative of T cell lymphocytes. And the bone marrow biopsy shows 26.9% lymphoblasts, so more than 25%. She's diagnosed with T cell ALL, acute lymphocytic leukemia. Next slide, please. She's starting her induction, and this is a pediatric inspired regimen. So the AALL0434, very common. All those different drugs that I talked about previously. In T cell, we add nilarabine, which is specifically a purine analog that specifically targets T cells. So it's T cell targeted and adds a significant advantage to those patients with T cell disease. And then she gets the typical variation here of daunorubicin, pegasparaginase. Again, she's in that adult AYA category. The pegasparaginase, which again is the frontline vincristine prednisone. So it looks a lot like things that you might see in lymphomas, like an R-CHOP type mixture. But you can also see the complexity of the days of the, you know, days in the week or the month. So it's very intensive therapy. Next slide, please. So what are the risk factors for patients receiving asparaginase? And this is specific to asparaginase, not the whole regimen. Hypersensitivity. This tends to be in the second dose and future doses. So it's upfront. There are some polymorphisms that put people at greater risk, more common in younger patients with no pre-meds. And then thrombosis, very common up front. Some of that has to do with the presence of the disease. A lot of these people end up getting lines. But you can also see all the factors that we typically think of in patients who are at risk for clotting as also risk factors. Hypofibrinogenemia, so low fibrinogen level, is generally very much in the front line also. So these are the early onset side effects. And obesity is one of the risk factors for that. And then high bilirubin, high LFT, so hyperbilirubinemia is also during those initial cycles. And this is true of each drug. So sometimes when you change to a different drug, you might see an early spike. But generally, that's closer to induction. And again, some of those risk factors are the dose of the pegasparaginase, if they have existing low albumin, low platelets, older age and obesity, and then certain genomic predispositions. Next slide, please. And then we start to see things that come on later or have variable onset, hypertriglyceridemia. This can be pretty significant if they're already at risk for that. They have a high BMI or a younger age. Hyperglycemia can be variable. Prednisone is a big part of this, but asparaginase can also cause a hyperglycemia just independently. And sometimes this is super high, like greater than 500, particularly in people with pre-existing diabetes. Hyperammonemia, I talked a little bit about the mechanism of action, right? It's breaking this down into aspartic acid and ammonia. And so you can see high ammonia levels as those cells are breaking down, and that may be indicative of you know, a silent inactivation. So really important to measure those ammonia levels. We'll come back to that. Pancreatitis, although rare, can be severe. And there are certain risk factors there as well. Next slide, please. So when we look at one of the risk factors, I've talked about obesity and BMI across many of these, you can see that this makes a big difference in terms of the significance of a number of these toxicities, but certainly liver, you know, or hepatic enzyme elevation, hyperbilirubinemia, pancreatitis, hypertriglyceridemia. And you can see that there is definitely, in some cases, statistically significant increases in patients who are obese for these disorders, or at least a higher incidence overall. Next slide, please. And that's just highlighting those that are statistically significant. Next slide. So now we're back to our case. So she's received her first dose of pegasparaginase on day 4, which is typical. She's in the hospital because she was admitted. This is newly diagnosed. We get going right away. 30 minutes after starting her pegasparaginase, she's gotten 50% of the dose. She now has urticaria, pruritus, sorry about that, flushing, and I'm sorry, but no bronchospasm, hypoxia, or GI symptoms. So it's a grade 2. Infusion is stopped. We give additional meds. All symptoms resolve in 30 minutes, and she's successfully rechallenged at a slower rate. However, the next morning, she reports a headache, nausea, vomiting, myalgias, and she is more anxious than usual. Next slide. So when we look at ammonia, if you think about high ammonia levels, we often think about the chronic liver disease population, or the, you know, the alcohol-induced cirrhosis in those patients. And but this, when you think about how the drug works and breaking down asparaginase into aspartic acid and ammonia, those high levels can indicate silent inactivation, as I mentioned. And the normal ranges vary by age and gender. So it's really important to understand that that is a thing. And generally in the lab, they'll report normal levels for a patient based on age, but it's important for you to check on that. And also just to check the level in anyone who we think may have had a mild reaction or is having these symptoms that we're going to blame on the drug itself. In fact, it may be the breakdown of the asparaginase and this higher level of ammonia. And so we always think, oh, nausea, vomiting, headache, fatigue, anxiety, that's probably prednisone and you know, the drug, but in fact, it can be an ammonia level. So there are risk factors for this, primarily pre-existing liver disease, but again, this anxiety, malaise, weakness, nausea, vomiting, and abdominal cramping may be ammonia. We don't really know how best to prevent it in people that have chronic liver disease or alcoholic cirrhosis. We try to increase protein intake, limit protein breakdown, so limit strenuous activity. We use lactulose, benzoic acid, and then you can also use arginine or sodium phenylbutyrate. But it's important to just measure the level so you understand whether they may have silent inactivation. Next slide, please. And that basically is a surrogate marker. Serum or asparaginase activity is a surrogate marker for asparagine levels. So we can measure that. Remember, asparagine is, you know, we want to reduce that because that's what feeds the leukemia. So asparagine depletion is critical to effective suppression of the leukemic clone. So we want a higher asparaginase level, which gives us a lower asparagine level. So more asparaginase, less asparagine, less leukemia. So we monitor those, therapeutic drug monitoring. It's included in the NCCN guidelines. Very early adoption in Europe we're getting there in the United States. It is a CLIA certified test, and the turnaround time is about a week. Next slide, please. And this is just an example of how that test would look. And again, this would be dictated by your institution in terms of how you send this out. But again, really important to our goal is to be greater than 0.1. Again, higher asparaginase level, less asparagine depletion. It means leukemic clone suppression. Next slide. Then when we look at hypersensitivity versus inactivation, so hypersensitivity is generally surrounding the infusion itself and generally very much, sometimes immediate, sometimes delayed, but mostly immediate. It's antibody mediated, whereas silent inactivation, they may or may not develop symptoms during their infusion. It may come later or maybe very mild and we think it's nothing. But if there are questions, it's important to do that therapeutic drug monitoring so that we can detect the silent inactivation. Next slide, please. So you've now drawn the serum ammonia level for this patient who's 24. Her serum asparaginase level is greater than 0.1. Yay, that's our threshold, that's our goal. The serum ammonia level, however, is 130. And the normal range is 29 to 112, so it's high. So she's given antiemetics and fluids and her symptoms improve. Next slide. But she comes to the clinic for follow-up after her discharge. She's still been in the hospital here. She now has a PICC liner in her right arm placed during her hospital stay, and she has swelling and pain. So we get a Doppler. Sure enough, she's got a DVT. And she started on low molecular weight heparin and then transitioned to a direct oral anticoagulant, do a CT to make sure she doesn't have a PE, and that's negative. Next slide. So thrombosis, as I mentioned earlier, is very common in the earlier phases of treatment. So these are graded, much like all adverse events, using the CTCAE grading criteria. And so generally, grade 1, we just monitor. Grade 2, there needs to be an intervention. Grade 3 and 4 is more severe. And so these are going to be more the PEs or intracardiac thrombosis. Grade 4 is life-threatening, and or these are neurological thrombi, so strokes. So we want to evaluate the history of thrombosis in those patients. They may need prophylaxis. There's some work nationally, internationally, about who's at risk and should we put them on prophylaxis in those early stages of therapy. That's not in the guidelines at this point. Monitoring them very closely, particularly if they have a line. In those patients who develop low fibrinogen levels, the treatment for that is cryoprecipitate because it contains clotting factors. But if somebody has a clot, you do not want to be giving them clotting factors. So understanding their fibrinogen level during this process is really important. And then if they remember, this is combination therapy. So we just talked about adriamycin. They can also get Cytoxan. Those drugs can cause myelosuppression and cytopenias. So if they're on an anticoagulant, that you have to monitor their platelet count closely. It gets to be pretty complicated in these early phases of therapy. And then for non-CS CNS thrombosis, so grade 2 or greater, so, DVT or even a PE, we start them on a low molecular weight heparin and then transition to a direct oral anticoagulant. And then we can, upon resolution of those symptoms, consider resuming asparaginase. So we would continue the asparaginase. It's not a reason to stop indefinitely, but it is something where we're going to monitor them very closely. If they have CNS thrombosis or ischemia or a stroke, if they're less than grade 3, so it's mild, we may consider resuming. If it's grade 3 or greater, we permanently discontinue asparaginase. So really important to monitor these patients closely for thrombosis. Next slide. So our patient has started on anticoagulation. Her pain and swelling have improved. So she resumes her asparaginase, but continues her anticoagulation. And we're going to continue to monitor all of the labs that I've mentioned. Next slide. This is an algorithm. This is a really great paper that speaks to silent inactivation and therapeutic drug monitoring. So this algorithm is a little bit complicated. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but I think the idea here is if you have a question of hypersensitivity, the idea is that you're creating antibodies against asparaginase, and then that asparaginase level may be subtherapeutic because now you've produced antibodies in your system, which is what happens when you're having drug reactions, hypersensitivity, or I should say infusion reactions. And so we're going to measure that. If it's greater than 0.1, that's good. That means there's a therapeutic level. We're going to continue to monitor. We're going to also evaluate that ammonia level. If the reaction is more severe, more antibodies, we're going to again check that level and then really decide how severe it was and whether they should be rechallenged based on that level of severity. Obviously up those pre-meds. Next slide, please. So she's rechallenged with PEG asparaginase, but she develops now Reiger's fever, systemic urticaria, severe back pain, hypotension, nausea, vomiting after just 30% of the volume. So she's now a grade 3 because we now have more than one organ system involved. And so it stopped and she's not going to be rechallenged. So she's grade 3 or greater. You're going to draw again a serum ammonia level because anytime there's a reaction, you have to really understand, is there a high ammonia level? Is she subtherapeutic? So we're going to draw a serum ammonia level and also draw an asparaginase level. And that level is less than 0.05, so below our threshold, which was 0.1. And her ammonia level is 110, it's normal. So we can't really blame it on the ammonia. What we are seeing here really is subtherapeutic asparaginase levels or silent inactivation. Next slide, please. So let's talk more about hypersensitivity. Next slide, sorry. And so just differentiating infusion reaction, allergic reaction, silent inactivation, and hyperammonia. So again, some of these are antibody mediated. If you think about antibody mediated, that's the potential to produce antibodies to asparaginase. And again, you're going to need to check for that silent inactivation. Silent inactivation, patients do develop these antibodies and they may not have signs or symptoms. So even in mild reactions, you're going to need to question this and monitor that. For those patients who may not be reaching therapeutic levels, we talked about how important that is over time in the very beginning of this. So this therapeutic drug monitoring is really critical in these patients who may have either mild or more severe symptoms, where you're going to look for high ammonia level. If that's negative, definitely serum asparaginase levels to look for silent inactivation. Next slide, please. And then there's immune mediated versus non-immune mediated. And again, those immune mediated is where you're forming those antibodies. And the non-immune mediated are things like the hyperammonemia, where it may mimic some of those symptoms that you think about, but it's really that breakdown of asparaginase. Next slide. So hypersensitivity reactions are indicative of the development of these neutralizing antibodies to asparaginase, as I mentioned, and re-exposure to the same formulation can lead to phagocytosis of asparaginase. You're just breaking it down, so you're not getting therapeutic levels. You have a shorter half-life. You have lower asparaginase activity, so that less than 0.1. It reduces the asparagine depletion. So more asparagine means more leukemia, and again, increases the severity of hypersensitivity reactions. Next slide, please. This is just looking at that pre-medication. It can reduce the risk of hypersensitivity, but it may mask those mild or even moderate reactions. And so for those patients who are heavily pre-medicated, we also need to consider just measuring those SAA levels to know that we are achieving therapeutic dosing. Next slide, please. Then we move on to how do we prevent this? I think we're all pretty good at this. We're so used to giving monoclonal antibodies and all of the things that are associated, taxanes, platinums that are associated with hypersensitivity. But I think what's really important is just know the patient, know the plan, what's the risk of hypersensitivity, pre-medicate. In this case, know that you may also want to check for the SAA levels because that might mask those antibody hypersensitivity reactions and the antibody formulation or formation, and then have a plan. You know, have your intervention plan, rapid response team, whatever, you know, standing orders in your center to be able to intervene quickly. You know, stop the infusion, give the meds, call for help, all the things that we know how to do. In severe hypersensitivity, the thing that kills people are airway symptoms, and this is where you need to move on to epinephrine. In the more severe cases to protect that airway. Next slide, please. So this is our 24-year-old female with T-cell ALL. She's moved to asparaginase or Winia chrysanthema because of the reaction to the PEG asparaginase and actually was first started on Erwinia native because it was that time and the Erwinia recombinant was not ready yet. So this is just showing you that transition. But you see here the liver enzymes, these big spikes as those drugs are introduced, and then, but they resolve, right? So they have these big peaks after the dose and then boom, you know, a few days after the dose, but then resolve. Similarly, the fibrinogen activity is depleted, but you can see it resolves on its own generally. Glucose levels can be very much elevated because of the asparaginase. Also, there's concurrent prednisone here, but they also generally resolve spontaneously. And then similarly, triglycerides can have a big peak and then resolve spontaneously. So we do need to monitor these, but in most cases, these are not a reason to discontinue therapy. Next slide. So hyperbilirubinemia, so grade 3 or greater is 3 times the upper limit or 3 to 10 times the upper limit of normal. And this is up to, you know, almost 40% of the adults treated. Transaminitis is common. You can see that. Risk factors, the induction cycle, so that initial exposure to the drug, even when we change drugs, that can happen. And I just showed you that example, higher doses of asparaginase, and then other risk factors for the liver, obesity, low albumin, low platelet count, and then those polymorphisms that I mentioned previously. Next slide. And it's almost always reversible, as I mentioned. It's most common after the initial dose of these individual drugs. Time to onset is about 2 weeks. So you saw it was a little bit of a lag after exposure where that would bump up. And it can take up to 4 weeks to resolve. So we do monitor those over time, really important. What's very important, though, is to look at what are the drugs are they taking? Are they hepatotoxic? Do we make adjustments to their concomitant meds? And then you're gonna just delay their therapy until that resolve to grade 1 or less and then resume. So it's not by itself a reason to discontinue therapy. Next slide. And then when we look at pancreatitis, this again, there are risk factors, older age, Native American ancestry, higher cumulative doses, so continued exposure, and the specific asparaginase formulation. In this case, we're going to treat the pancreatitis, which is generally supportive care and really limiting other drug exposure. If it's only a grade 2 and radiological findings only, we may reintroduce the drug, but anything more than that, and we discontinue it permanently because this can be serious and life-threatening. And so pancreatitis is one of those where even if it resolves over time, we're not going to re-expose them to asparaginase. Next slide. And then hypofibrinogenemia or hemorrhage, you know, less fibrinogen, higher risk of bleeding. Also not an indication to discontinue therapy. We are going to monitor those patients, and that would include measuring that fibrinogen level, PTPTT, prior to each dose. And if it's too low, we might pause and let that resolve. But also, we're going to measure it after the dose. And if it's less than 50, we're going to consider giving cryoprecipitate. Again, that contains clotting factors, and then monitor for that concurrent thrombocytopenia. Next slide. Hypertriglyceridemia, all the things we normally think about, diet, obesity, comorbidities like diabetes, are going to increase that risk. Next slide. And we're just gonna basically use diet and exercise. We're also going to monitor those patients for pancreatitis because those two things are related. And then we give drugs, specifically triglyceride drugs, not cholesterol, but triglycerides. So the fibrates, fenofibrate or gemfibrozole are really our most commonly used drugs. And again, if it's significantly elevated, we may hold the drug temporarily or delay the next dose until that's normalized, but not discontinue permanently. Next slide. Hyperglycemia, again, pre-existing makes sense if they already have diabetes, concurrent steroids, which are very much a part of these regimens. You know, avoid simple sugars. If they're on diabetic medication, they may need to adjust that. If they're on an oral anti-diabetic, they might need to start insulin during this time. And then we're going to really monitor them after each dose of asparaginase. But we can continue therapy. It's not a reason to discontinue. Next slide. So what are we going to talk to patients and family members about? This is complicated. It's a huge commitment. It's really difficult for people to work during those initial months of therapy. So it's roughly 4 to 6 months of therapy. Once they get into the maintenance phase, they get monthly doses of vincristine and then otherwise oral drugs. For those people who are T-cell, they get the nalirabine, depending on the protocol, every third or fourth cycle or month. There's a lot of intrathecal therapy over time. And so once they get to maintenance, it's usually every 3 months. Some people do it every other month. But they can work, you know, theoretically they can work. But during that initial phase, it's very, very difficult. They're in, they're out, they can be admitted and discharged. And we try to do as much as we can in the outpatient setting, but it's really, really demanding to the patient and to their caregivers. So a lot of education. A lot of education around how important it is to receive all of the therapy on time. In the maintenance phase, some of our younger patients are like, I am over this, and they are, you know, it's hard to get them to show up. So instilling a little bit of healthy, you know, fear in that this is cancer and we want you to have the best outcome. And in order to do that, I need you to be here. So really being honest about the effect of missing doses is really, really critical. Next slide. So asparaginase, essential component of treatment for pediatric adolescent, young adult, and adult patients with ALL and LBL. Subtherapeutic dosing of asparaginase is associated with inferior outcomes. We know that IgG complex neutralizing antibodies to asparaginase can develop even in mild or asymptomatic reactions and therefore have subtherapeutic levels. So to make sure we're getting the dose that we need, we want to do therapeutic drug monitoring for those serum asparaginase levels or serum asparaginase assays and monitor for that silent inactivation. So again, our target greater than 0.1. In the future, there's really a move and some of the clinical trials are looking at dosing asparaginase according to the serum level. So stay tuned for that. Also looking at pharmacogenomics in terms of risk for toxicities and other strategies to minimize or mitigate those toxicities.
Thank you, Dr. Curtin, for sharing your valuable teaching and expertise. And with that, we'll conclude our program. Thank you again for your participation this evening.